You are listening to episode 149 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast, The Grumpy Tenth Man.
Welcome to episode 149 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is August the 3rd, 2014. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and this is the guardian of the bro-alexy, James Furlough. You're totally on mute, bub.
I am James.
You are James, the guardian of the bro-alexy. Oh, I got you. I get it. We are James. Did I just give away the
spoilers
of the movie?
Spoilers! It's too
Come
soon.
On. We didn't see it coming, you know. So what'd you think? So you got to see it, presumably?
I did. I did see it. As you recall on a previous podcast, I was kind of dogging on it.
Yeah.
We can, if we were technologically advanced enough, I would be like, play that clip of me dogging on it. And it would sound something like, man, I don't know why everyone's so excited about it. I see the trailers and it just looks dumb and campy. But gosh, the ratings are good, so there must be something there, but I just don't get it. Maybe I'm getting old. It was something like that.
Yeah, that was something along those lines. That was a pretty good interpretation of the YouTube video.
Yeah, thank
you. The irony of us needing the technology is literally you just type the URL into the Google Hangout. It would have just taken 5 minutes of prep work to find the clip. Google would have done the rest.
That requires to do 5 minutes of prep work. So
right.
There's that.
That's not how we roll.
Yeah, no. So I watched it. It wasn't bad. I enjoyed myself. It was funny enough to make up for the campiness of it all.
Yeah. My review so far has been I was in a terrible mood when I watched it. I was with a bunch of friends and family, and I was snappy and mean to pretty much all of them. We're blaming it on low blood sugar. I don't really have a particular excuse other than I was just in a bad mood. And I still enjoyed the movie, despite just being, like, super annoyed by the 3D the whole time and, like, feeling completely disengaged. So I think I'm sitting there going, if I was in that bad of a mood and still watched out of the movie, it's pretty good. It must have been great. That's the only explanation.
Maybe I can't ask you this right now, but I've had a few people ask me, like, where it ranks to the other nine.
Oh, jeez. That's tough. Okay, all of a sudden the echo started.
I'll fix it.
Thank you. It's one of those things where it's obviously Avengers is better. I like the various Irons Mans better, but they're my faves. I probably liked it more than a couple of the last Cap America.
I wasn't recording this entire thing. Fantastic. That's what we have YouTube for.
Yes, thank you, Google. I'd say. I'd say it probably ranks above the Thor movies and the Captain America movies, but below the Iron Man and the Avengers movies.
Hmm. Okay, all right.
I think as a science fiction goes, Thor is not supposed to be, like, very sci-fi. It's supposed to be more mythic.
Fantasy?
Yeah, whereas it's the whole Arthur C. Clarke, he's sufficiently advanced technology is indiscernible from magic, so it's supposed to feel magic-y. Whereas this one felt science fiction-y, which is just, that's more up my ballpark anyways. And
yeah,
I tend to...
Well, I was like, for people who have asked me, I'm like, have you seen Firefly?
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, did you like Firefly? Then you will like this movie.
Oh, yeah, probably. That makes sense. Have you seen Firefly?
Yeah.
Okay. Have I ever told you the story of my Firefly experience?
Yeah, I feel like you have, but refresh my memory.
So I watched, I saw the trailers for Firefly on Fox. I was super excited about it. I thought it was going to be great. I was so excited for the TV show. I set the time aside. I sat down and watched the first three episodes as they aired live. And any hardcore fan of Firefly will tell you they know exactly what that means. I hated the show because Fox aired the first three episodes out of order. So it didn't make any sense. Like, really? Who are these characters? Yeah, they didn't play the pilot first. They played it third. They played the third episode second and the second episode first. It was all wacky. And so by the time we got to, like...
I mean, that's just not, oh, we did it backwards. That's just wrong.
Yes. I mean, it was just atrocious. And that's largely blamed for why the show didn't make it past episode 9. It was funny. I was like right in line with that. Like, I was like, what is this garbage? This is stupid. And I've actually never gone back and watched all 9 of them. Partly because so many of my friends are so heartbroken about it. I just don't, where I'm left, I don't feel bad about it. I don't feel like I missed out on anything. I gave it a good shot and it was terrible. I feel like justice was served. Now I realize like logically I know that that's not the truth. But
it's available on Netflix, you know that, right?
I do know that. But it doesn't feel like I missed anything. Whereas all my friends who have watched it in order feel like they missed something, like, great, and it just went terribly wrong. And so I'm like, do I really want to do that to myself? Do I want to go from where I'm at to where I'm fine with it to, you know, wishing there was more? Why would I do that to myself on purpose? That's kind of where I've been. That's actually the biggest reason why I've avoided it.
Okay. Fair enough.
Since I'm technically one of the ones to blame for it not making it pass, because I was the target audience and I didn't stick it out.
Well, yeah. I mean, they had the movie Serenity afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
But
ironically, did watch that.
Did the movie make any sense to you?
No, not really. None of it makes any sense to me. I don't really get any of what's going on.
That's seriously?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's like, just think of it, that's a 2-hour finale, essentially.
Yeah,
which
and
now I would be like, yeah, don't watch the show because you've like ruined it for yourself or something. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, you totally boned that entire thing up.
And I like never do that to TV shows, but
that's amazing.
They're so upset about how it came down. I just don't even want to. I don't want to put myself through it.
I'm not upset because, you know, I wasn't there when it happened. It's just someone recommended it to me. It was like, oh, you should watch this. It's pretty good. It's short. Got canceled. Blah blah blah. But it's good. So that, you know, that was where my expectation was walking into it. So I was like, all right, fine. You know, 9 episodes or whatever it was. I can do that in a week and. I did, but
maybe it's time that I give it another try. But you know what, James? We're not here to talk about Firefly or Serenity or the Guardians of the Galaxy. We are here this week, like every week, to talk about technology and the continuing corporate opera. And by that, we mean the soap opera of corporations' dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and, of course, the technology they're developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, James has got a short disclosure he's got to throw our way so he doesn't get fired.
I own a Pebble watch. It is a smartwatch. And at the same time, I work for HP. But I do not represent HP or any of HP's opinions or necessarily endorse any of HP products or concepts of a product or vaporware announcements of a product.
..
That's my disclosure / teaser.
Yeah, right. Cool. Well, I'll let that one just hang out there a little bit.
P.S. I think I'm headed down the Dvorak track of just becoming grumpy and old, and it's infuriating, which I guess is appropriate.
What do you mean?
Grumpy about becoming grumpy. Well, I'm just like.
Oh, I got you.
I'm downer about the movie, downer about this other stuff. Spoiler alert, I'm not totally pumped and awesome about HP's watch. I'm becoming grumpy or something. I don't want to be that person.
I get the whole Dvorak thing. If for those of you who just listen to us and don't pay attention to any other tech media, he is a blogger who's notoriously down on all technology. Like he's like a big time Apple hater. Every time he does an article in Mac Daily News, puts a post about it. They add a couple of his more infamous quotes where he attacks the iPhone as being unnecessary technology and being a terrible idea. And then the last one they always add is the quote of his where he said, "There's no evidence that anybody is looking for a pointer device that they call a mouse." And then they quote him from the 1980s and
nice.
Make him look like an absolute moron every time he like, really, really. Sometimes being the naysayer is you're just being the naysayer. You're not actually adding anything to the conversation. Ironically, I'm going to advocate that people like him are a good idea later in the show for companies like Amazon, but we'll get there. So if you want to follow us throughout the week, we try to be interesting and entertaining throughout the course of the week, at least to some degree, you know, as best we can. We got a couple social media things you can check out. My Instagram is nextwiggin4. My Twitter is @MatthewDFurlow, all one word, lowercase, with an at symbol at the front, not the word at. Hence, you know, heads up.
I am @JamesFurlow everywhere.
Everywhere.
But the at is only on Twitter. Everyone else, there's no at symbol.
Gotcha.
Spelled or symbol.
Hmm. Interesting. So if
how
you want to.
How confusing would that be, though? And I feel like someone's done it somewhere. They've just added the word at the beginning of their name.
At Matthew D. Furlow?
Yeah.
Yeah. Then, yeah.
That just feels like
you know what the
level of confusion that some high schooler would do because they're cool.
Yeah. And then, yeah. You know what? Oh, yeah. That's totally something I would do in high school. And what I would actually do is I'd be like, I'd make like a Star Wars-based account because I'm a total dork. And I'd have the at account, which is the really, you know, the giant walking thing from episode 5. For those of you who don't know, but if you want to follow, if you want to know more about the show, and stuff that's going on, we got a website, thefurlowbros.com. There we put all the articles, links, clicks, all that fun stuff. Any videos or sound clips or anything we talk about, we put all that there. James does a fantastic job of posting it all, the YouTube video. Just check it out. It's worth it.
Yeah, and the admin panel is magically working again, so I can actually get in and don't have to do it on my phone, so it'll actually happen at a reasonable time.
Thanks, WordPress. We appreciate it.
Yeah, who knows if we did it.
Yeah, nobody knows. It's unknowable.
Well, they were saying that sometimes you'll get like a spike in traffic, which I wish this was the case, but usually it's from attackers. And so your ISP, or is it your ISP? No, your web host will actually block access to that because they think you're being attacked, and so they block access to everybody.
What if we're just really popular? Jeez. Thanks, Church.
Could be. It could be. I don't know.
Except the website was available.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they make the website available. Part of that's too, I've got it flowing through a CDN, a content data network that caches everything for us.
Hey, so, we get to talk about those this week too, man. This is just like we are full of spoilers in this shit in the opening. This they're not spoil. Well, yeah, I guess technically spoilers, but we like to call them teases.
So I'm gonna start.
Okay, go for it.
Your articles first, because I have like 3 intro articles.
So. Oh, you're so cool.
Yeah, I know I am. I saw this and I just thought it was a hilarious idea. This guy, I don't know. He's an artist, of course. Corey Archangel. Nah, that can't be his real name. He's an artist. It's got to be a fake name. Anyways, he's writing a book that collates people's tweets.
Oh, this
that includes the phrase.
It's a painful book. Yeah, go for it.
Working on my novel.
Yeah.
So, it's pretty hilarious. He literally is going through tweets, and so a couple examples are currently working on my novel and listen to really nice music. Yeah, I'm a writer. Deal with it. That's from Sierra Brown. Another one says, I'm working on my novel again, and it feels good, you guys. I love my mind. That's from another tweeter out there. And that's the book.
I hate and love this idea. Yeah. Oh, God. Oh, man. It's just so painful. It's so painful because writers, like, especially, like, oh, jeez. Oh, my gosh. Oh, like, I love this sort of thing. I love the technology of it. So for my personal experience, for those of you who have been listening to the show for a long time, occasionally I'll mention the fact that I'm an amateur writer, and I'm, like, in the process of trying to get a book published, like, you know, yep. doing a thing, having a fun time. And I built a website for it. Part of it was just practicing building websites. Part of it I thought it would be fun and cool and interesting for my website or for my book and story, and it gave me something to work on and develop. But part of that whole process was setting up a blog. And I got blogged twice before I realized this is the worst. Blogging about writing a book is literally the worst topic to blog about ever, because you're going to blog about one of two things. You're either going to give away all the spoilers and all the things that you're talking about or that you're writing about, or you're just going to talk about, like, the writing process, and you just sound like a DB. I mean, it's awful. Like, there's just no way to sound cool as a writer, like, especially if you haven't actually published anything yet. It's just – and even if you were, like, a major publisher and you're just talking about writing, you sound awful. You sound just – oh, gosh. You either – like, there's just no – there's no good way to talk about writing. There's no good way you can't. You can't. There's no way to write with humility and talk about your writings. It's just, I've decided that. And so when I talk about my writings, because I tend to be an external processor and it just helps me think about it, the whole time I'm, like, internally cringing about the fact that I'm talking about my writings, because I know exactly how it sounds to people. Oh, it's terrible. It's a terrible place to be.
Yeah, so this guy's actually getting published by Penguin.
Yeah, dude, I'll bet Penguin's freaking loving it. I'll bet in, like, it's publishing houses. You know, it's funny. I should just get it. I should just get it. Have it be like
No, I got a perfect Christmas idea for you.
You know what? Honestly, though, like, okay, I'll tell you what, James. My birthday's in 2 weeks. Christmas is in 4 months. I won't buy it till 2015. I'll put it on my list, but I won't buy it. So if it somehow ends up in my clutches. But that's the sort of thing that I'm going to put that on a coffee table so that when friends come over, they pick it up and they read it and they laugh at it, just so I can remind myself to not sound like a pretentious a-hole.
It reminds me of that other book that was selling just millions of copies, that it was like another one of those talking stuffer type things where it would be on the counters of checkout places. Like Staples, or no, not Staples, but Kinko's always sold books. And I shouldn't make fun of them, because I bought one of the books and it's fantastic and I reference it all the time. But anyways, the book title was Everything Men Know About Women. Yeah. And it was like a 100-page book or something. 100% blank.
That's commitment. That's funny.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I saw them for probably $10 a pop, would be my guess, and just sold a ton of copies. Oh, yeah. I mean, I love it. You know, that kind of stuff. You're like, yes, that is creative. That's like that Kickstarter campaign with the potato salad, you know? That's what it is.
Yeah.
So creative and getting rewarded for it.
Yeah, and they deserve it.
Yeah, yeah. But anyways, pretty funny.
That's very funny. That is very funny. Oh, man. All right, well, yeah. Put that on the list. What's the book called?
I don't know. I already closed it.
Hashtag am writing a novel?
That sounds...
I'll have to look at it. Basically, just go to the website. If you're curious, go to thefurlerbros.com and look at the article. It's right there.
And there is a hilarious, hilarious two-minute clip of Stewie bugging Brian the dog from Family Guy about writing his novel.
There are like three clips from Family Guy that I would say everybody, or like your top three clips. And this one's may not be the top clip from Family Guy ever. Definitely top three though. Very easily. Maybe top one. I mean, it's a classic.
I'd play it, but I don't want to get kicked off YouTube. So
right.
Not gonna do it. But yeah, no. Anyways. It's worth watching.
Yeah.
Just
right now. Got some plot. Got some stress.
Start. Finish. Yeah. Protagonist.
Oh my gosh! I love that. So yeah, do you want to go again, or you want
yeah,
to go?
Sure.
What's
I was
that?
Trying to turn on my lights.
Oh, did it work?
No, because I don't have a clapper.
Yeah.
Light. But, you know, it's funny. I actually had this exact thought like 2 weeks ago when you were asking me about whether or not the Hue, Philips Hue light bulb was able to interact with if this, then that.
Yeah.
To which the answer is yes, by the way.
It is.
And
I know.
What's that? What is that? What? Dude, when did you get that? Is that the Hue starter kit?
Yeah, it is. So I've been threatening to do it for a while. For those of you that aren't watching but are listening, we've got the Hue starter kit. So this is the deal.
Question, why is it still in the box? Is it 2 weeks? What's the deal here?
So I got it yesterday, and I opened up the my fan's light, and turns out in California there are efficiency requirements for fans, for ceiling fans, which is the main lighting fixture in my room. And one of the things that they did when they defined what is a fan, and part of a fan that needs to hit these requirements is having a type of fan with a what they call an E27 or a medium-sized socket, which is what the standard like light bulb socket is. Mm-hmm. Thing is, there are smaller fans that aren't like room fans that traditionally had what they called candelabra sockets, or the E24, I think is true, or E23. But the smaller light sockets, well, those didn't have to have the energy efficiencies because they were very small. So,
awesome.
So Ding, the modern fan manufacturer said, well, what if we just build a full-size fan but with a non-standard socket, one of these candelabra sockets, and then we don't have to hit the energy efficiencies? So you pretty much can't buy fans anymore with standard size sockets, which is really frustrating. So I have to decide if I'm going to buy a highly dangerous converter from China that will make it impossible to fit the light bulb inside of the fixture, so I'll always have the glass off and look ugly, but they cost like $3, and they will probably catch the house on fire, or I can buy a standing lamp, which I hate standing lamps, and go that route. Or I can return the Hue, and I'm debating. I'm weighing
so
the
three. They don't make any fans that have a standard light set in them.
You probably can buy them. You can probably buy them somewhere, but most especially like your affordable ones. They all go with the candelabra because they don't have to. They don't have to hit the energy efficiency stuff. So it's I don't know. It's dumb. But
I feel like it might be worth your effort to take a stroll to Home Depot or Lowe's.
I already did. And
they'll go, huh?
Yeah. So you know, it's not a big deal. Not a big deal. Oh, I'm going to look into it a little bit more, see what I can't figure out. But the big thing was I have a friend who works for Best Buys, and he bought it for himself, and then I paid it back to him, so I got the employee discount, and which was significantly
like 200
more,
bones to
for the starter kit. Yeah, it's significantly more affordable when a Best Buy employee purchases them.
Just out of curiosity, can you disclose the employee discount right here?
For this particular product, it was about 40% off.
That's not bad.
Not bad at all.
Nice.
For light bulbs
that
last 20 years?
Yeah, that's cool.
Anyways, we were talking about something else. I totally distracted you.
Yeah, I was. So you were asking me about that. You know, does it work with if this and that? And I was... You know, and I looked it up, and the answer is yes. You can do all sorts of stuff, turn off and on the lights, change colors, make them blink, you know, whatever. Because they're LEDs, apparently they can do that. So, you know, kind of reading through it, I was like, man, this is missing everything but an easy way to turn the lights off and on. And I'm not the only one, apparently, who was thinking this. There is a company out there who have created, though they're currently doing a Kickstarter campaign, to bring voice control to the light switch called the Voca, which I guess makes sense. And so it is the modern day clapper where you, it's actually pretty cool. And in theory, it could go in between your Hue and your light socket. So it is like a little section that goes in between, which I guess if you have a cover, I don't know what would happen. But anyways, you know, you screw that into the light socket, and then you screw the light into the Voca, and what happens is it's powered by the light switch, and then or the socket, and then and it has Bluetooth low energy that'll then connect to your smartphone, and what you do is then on your you download the app and you give it a command. You know, you might say, "Okay, house, turn on light," or something. I don't know, and then turn off light. And then once you set the command, it then syncs it to your Voca thing, which also has a microphone on it. And then you're done, right? You doesn't have to turn on the app. The light memorizes, or you know, stores in memory and just always listens for the command. And so you can always just say, "Okay, lights out," or whatever you want, and it will turn your lights out for you. Boom! Looking to raise $40,000 on their Kickstarter campaign.
That's kind of cool.
And let's see here. I didn't look up the price yet. Let's see. If you order... I don't know. What is it? You can get your... It's $40.
That's not bad. For one?
Sure.
Not bad. Yeah, so this is obviously a competing product, but with the Hue...
Is it competing? I feel like they are
compatible. Well, maybe, I guess.
Maybe not. I think the whole idea, power.
Yeah, I guess I think the whole idea of the Hue is that you never turn it off. You know, it always has power. It's just you're lowering, you know, it's a ghost use. Philips did... they did launch a complimentary device, what they call the Tap Switch, and it's basically got four buttons on it that you can tap for different light settings for, you know, so you can, like, program it with stuff. So, because that was one of the complaints people had was, like, if you don't have the app, how do you turn the lights on in your house? Like, how does, like, guests turn the lights on?
Wait, so say that one more time. How does it work?
So so the dilemma that people were running into is if you got your whole house hooked up with these Hue light bulbs and a guest comes over, how do they turn the lights on? They don't have access to your app. So what it is is this little circular mount that you put on the wall, and it's got four buttons on it, and each one of the buttons has different settings, so you can turn on different stuff, and you can have multiple of them in your house. So you could have like one per room, and then you've got like the dim setting or the bright setting, or you know, the different stuff. Or you can have just one for your house, and it controls each room and stuff like that. You know, where it just turns lights on in this room, turns lights on in this room. And then the writer was so funny because he was like, I was like, man, this is brilliant. I'm totally gonna have to get that when I get my Hue. And then I realized, or then he pointed out the fact that the one flaw to the whole thing, if there was one complaint he had, is you can't just hit the button twice and have it turn it off, or go to the last state. So there's no like, you actually have to program one of the buttons as the off switch.
Huh.
Which is kind of annoying. And I was like, that is kind of annoying. That is really annoying. I hope they fix that with an update, because it seems like the sort of thing you could easily fix with an update.
Sounds like they got to put a microphone in there, too. To me, that just seems like an obvious add.
Well, what they said was the device is powered by kinetic energy, so a tap creates enough juice to complete each task, which a microphone and a microprocessor would be... All of a sudden, you need batteries. Man, it'd be annoying. Whereas this is just sort of a... standalone cool little device, which is pretty neat.
Well, I guess I was just thinking about that. I don't know if you put it on the light bulbs themselves, or I feel like this Voca is a cool idea, and it should be integrated into the light bulbs or the hubs or whatever.
I agree completely. I think it's sort of a if this then that task, or maybe something handled by an intermediary. But yeah, I agree. Having voice commanded stuff, you know, pulling the whole picture together is important. I agree.
I wonder, can you, again, I'm not going to think about guests right now, but, you know, could you do a Siri or an OK Google command? I could see that as an if this and that app type of, I don't know. I would, you know, could you create an app that's called Turn Off Lights or something? You know what I mean? This has got to be solvable.
So part of the whole HomeKit thing is the idea that Siri will hopefully have access to these types of API. So the idea is hopefully you will get to the point where you can say, all right, Siri, turn the lights off in my room, and it'll turn the lights off in your room.
Okay.
Ideally.
HomeKit, salvation. Got it.
Yeah. And as somebody who's fully immersed in the Apple ecosystem, it's how we roll. So.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. So anyways, cool little app or light product thing.
I like it. Hey, you're on a roll. Yeah, keep it going.
Too. Okay. Okay. So, okay, this one's a little bit, little longer, but we'll go with it. The Best Buy CEO, you know that company. We just talked about it, actually.
Good company, especially when they're making money.
Still around. He had some interesting things to say. The title of the article says that the tablet sales are crashing and that there's hope for PCs. And I have a counter to that argument, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But they asked him pretty much like, you know, so what's going on? And he essentially was like, well, actually PC sales have started to turn around a little bit, which is nice. And he says pretty much what happened is Microsoft stopped supporting Windows XP, and so people feel like they have to go out and buy a new laptop that it's not running XP anymore. So he's like, so that's good. And so he's like, sales are good. And then what he was saying is that tablet sales, you know, they boomed and now they're crashing. He's just like, from our standpoint, the volumes are gone. And even the Microsoft Surface tablet, he's like, you know, it's okay, but you know, it's just not. Yeah, sales aren't going well, and they're like, do you think that's just you, or do you think that's everybody? And he's like, no, I think it's everybody. And he says, part of the problem is that for the Windows market, the deflation has been enormous. So you can get laptops for like $300 that used to be $1,000. So he's like, they're just crazy affordable. And people are just finding that you can still do a lot on a laptop, a lot more on a laptop than you can do on a tablet, and they're just, you know, they're making a choice. And this idea, like, smartphones are getting bigger screen sizes, and so they're able to do a lot more. And he's just, you know, his whole point is that just, like, tablets are getting squeezed, essentially. And so, you know, that's what he sees. Now, what's also interesting about his about what they're doing is I thought this was fascinating – is he says that, you know, a lot of the other big box stores have run into the problems where there are showrooms for companies like Amazon. Sound familiar, right?
Yeah.
And so he says that their new strategy, he goes, we will price match everything. If you're in their store and you see a television and you pull it up on Amazon and you show them the phone, they will match that price.
Yeah.
Period. Which is kind of a big deal. And his whole thing is like, he's like, you're already in the store. You already know the TV you want. You can have it today.
Yeah.
You can take it home with you right now. You don't have to worry about shipping or whatever. He's like, and you don't have to worry about price. Plus, if you don't like it, you have a physical place you can return it to. And we have our Geek Squad that can help you if you have any technical problems.
Right.
Why would you not buy it from us when the price is exactly the same? Yeah, which I'm like
you.
That's actually a pretty decent argument.
Yeah.
if I've ever heard one. Now, is it sustainable as a business model? I don't know. I think he's kind of hoping that, you know, he hooks people like you and me who actually care about that kind of stuff. And furthermore, we recognize or how do I want to say it? We start to realize the value that they're providing and stop making them give us the discount to, quote, you know, we feel obliged to pay for the value add that they're giving.
Yeah.
Or something. I think that's part of this hope.
I think, you know, if I had to guess, I would say their goal is to survive at this point. even if that means surviving with much smaller profits than they've ever had. And their argument is going to be the cost that Amazon is paying is the same that everybody's paying the same wholesale. And so they're just going to take Amazon's margins and hope that they can survive still.
So he asks, is Best Buy going to be around in 5 years? He goes, we'll be around in 50 years. We have a unique role to play for customers, which I'm kind of like, as a CEO, you have to say that. It would be interesting to see the financial statements on what they actually think. But I also, hold on one second.
God bless you.
Wow. That was an excellent sneeze. Oh, it felt really good.
Sorry, bummed we missed it.
Yeah, no, you're not. Here, hold on. I gotta finish the dirty deed here.
Oh, man. This is funny. Go for it.
Okay. All right. I forgot what I was talking about. Yeah, so he thinks they're going to be around for a while. I would love to see the actual financials that back that up. But if anything, it's taking away an excuse, right? If someone's like, oh, it's always more expensive, you can say, no, we're not. Excuse gone. We're just as good. So hopefully they'll be around. I mean, there's no one else to stop them other than maybe Costco. So one of the things, again, he said, you know, tablet sales are crashing.
Yeah.
Now, and iPad sales are sinking fast. It's the beginning of the end for tablets. So CNN Money author David Goldman came out, and he was like, okay, tablets are still popular and sales are still growing at 11% last quarter. So they're not going down. He's like, and iPad sales, he goes, sure, they're down. They were a 9% decline last quarter, which was preceded by a 16% slump the quarter before that. It's like, so, all right, what's going on? So he goes, A, similar argument. Smartphones are getting bigger. And so therefore, you'll take a single tweener instead of two different devices. He says the other problem that we're running into is that tablets aren't subsidized, the same way that phones are.
Yeah.
And so, when you can buy a bigger phone for $200 versus a tablet for $800, you're like, I'm not going to spend the $800. I'll get the bigger phone. So he's like, they kind of got to figure that out for to make it happen.
Yeah.
And then he's like, the other problem is that these tablets are lasting a while.
Yeah. I'll be totally honest. That's my dilemma. I keep walking in the Apple store and looking at the iPad Mini Airs and keep thinking, and then like use my iPad Mini and go, my iPad Mini still works great for what I do with it. Like, I don't need another one. I just want something new, which is a really terrible reason to spend that much money.
It is. As your fiscally conservative brother, it is.
Yeah.
And so he was like, so you have that issue as well. Part of it's just because they don't get used the same way they do phones or laptops, is my guess. And then finally he says just businesses aren't buying tablets. They're just coming around, if we're honest about it, just coming around to phones. And they're still trying to find a place for the tablets. He goes, but what that also means is that there's a huge growth opportunity there. Which is one of the reasons why the Apple IBM announcement is as big as it is. Because if they can partner together and convince IT departments that having iPads is a good idea, that could be really good. So yeah. They're not dead, they're just resting.
One of the things I think is interesting is the idea that when Steve Jobs came on stage with the iPad, the intention of the iPad was to really have it be a new category of device. Like, he was very emphatic about that. And he, and a lot of people were like, well, that's going to eat the lunch of the laptops. But I think if you were to be honest with him, he would say, look, this isn't supposed to be necessarily a competition between laptops and tablets. They're supposed to be able to coexist for different purposes. I think the shelf life of the iPads is longer than the shelf life of the iPhones. I'm not exactly sure why that is from a technological perspective, but for my particular use, that is undeniably true. Part of it is the battery lasts longer. It's such a big battery that my iPad lasts for 4 or 5 days without charging. So for my normal use, whereas my iPhone only charges one day, and now that it's getting a little long in the tooth, it only lasts, you know, if I actually need to use it all day and I can't charge it with me, I've got a problem. Whereas my iPad, it's fine. It'll last a day and a half, you know, easy of regular use without ever, you know, bumping it up. So that's part of the problem, is that a lot of people, there's two reasons why you feel like your phone needs to be upgraded. A, it's getting slow. B, the battery's not lasting long. It's going to last a lot longer on a tablet than it will on a phone. And then as far as the overall operation, the overall performance of the tablet, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know why my iPad mini still feels very responsive and snappy, because where my iPhone might already start to feel like it's, you know, it's a little iOS 8 thing, it's gonna drag me down a little bit, if you know what I mean. And
so I was reading this other article, and I didn't link to it because I wasn't thinking we would go down this route, but it was Marco Armit, is that how you say it? The creator of all sorts of awesome things, helped to start up Tumblr, wrote Instapaper, did the magazine, and he just sold something else recently. he made an app for. People were like, we don't need another one of these. Oh, he made a podcasting app recently.
That's funny.
So this is a dude who, like, he's a great coder and designer and can kind of do whatever he wants, and he does cool things. Then he has a blog and he writes stuff about it. And he was talking about app rot. And he was talking specifically about iPad apps. He's like, take a look at your iPad right now. Look at your apps. How many of them have iOS 7 design interfaces versus iOS 6? How many of them have been updated recently versus not? He's like, you will find that the majority are old and or they're just blown up versions of the iPhone. And his point was that app development has actually become a commodity. There used to be, you know, Wild Wild West, and, you know, you and like two other guys could put together a team, make apps, make a ton of money, and, you know, life would be good. He's like, a lot of those have now shrunk back down just to sole proprietorships. It's just one dude out there making apps, and he's like, and they're surviving. They're not getting rich off of it, but they're doing okay. And his whole thing was like, the App Store has matured and has a search problem and doesn't have a good way of surfacing up good content for you. And so the point is to get out there, get downloads, and then once you have them, you move on to the next thing. There's no point in, you know, keeping up with the app. Mm-hmm. The other thing that he was saying is that it used to be, too, that to code for iPad apps or just Apple apps or whatever and all of the different stores in general, he said, required specialized engineers and was a true talent. He's like, now everyone knows how to code, and it's not special anymore. It's like HTML and CSS. You know, everyone knows the LAMP stack. You don't have to hire a specialized engineer to do that. Anybody can do it. And so you don't have special teams. You just now have back to your regular team.
Right.
And so what they're seeing is they are looking at the engagement that they're getting on iPads and iPhones and, you know, and Androids and Windows phones and stuff like that, and making choices on where they're going to spend their money and resources. And so his point being that oftentimes the iPad's the last thing to get updated. And so he's like, just because, you know, the nature of the beast, because you're not going to make a ton of money, so you're not going to hire a big team, and you're not going to go out and hire the best of the best specialized skills. You're going to get a run-of-the-mill person who can kind of do them all, and he's only got time for so many. And And so I think that, you know, that adds to the not, you know what I mean? It's a virtuous or non-virtuous cycle.
The best example I can think to kind of corroborate that is the fact that Paper by Facebook is, you know, the most used version of way to access Facebook. Anybody who's using Paper, that's their number one way to access Facebook.
Right. Because it's really good.
Yeah, because it's really good. And they haven't launched a Paper app for iPad yet. And there's no, they're not talking about it or anything. It's got they've got the Big Blue app and they've got Messenger. That's it. And Instagram, which is a completely different team. But it's mostly just a blown up app, a version of the phone app. And they, so, I mean, clearly, like you, I mean, as you were saying, man, it's, there's, there, that is the last, you know, as far as they're concerned in iOS, they don't spend much time thinking about that. Even with apps that are clearly successful, they're clearly going to be where mobile goes. They don't chase that down on the iPad very quickly. They come out with four new apps for the iPhone, which, you know, three of which are terrible ideas and one of which might have some, you know, staying power before they get around to the iPad version of Paper, which is clearly the way to go. You know, and but because, yeah, like you said, it's an engagement thing. They're not seeing the engagement. They're actually, it's way more valuable to have another hit on the iPhone than it is to port a hit to the iPad.
Yeah, or spend that time developing it for Android and, you know, ignoring both the Apple and Android tablets.
Right.
And it's just not your, yeah, it's just not worth spending the time on that. So it was an interesting article, an interesting thought. And I think that further adds to, you know, should I buy an iPad? I don't know.
Yes.
Do you want to build a snowman? These are really tough questions.
They are tough questions. You know, yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. It's tough. It's tough.
Not really. I mean, Apple's making so much money. They can deal with that kind of tough for a while.
Exactly. So speaking of smartphones and which operating systems do you want to be developing your apps for?
Yeah.
One that you don't want to develop your apps for is Tizen. Samsung's proprietary operating system that they were they made a couple of smartwatches using it. They're trying to push it on to TVs and phones and stuff. And the whole idea was, you know, when Samsung was doing huge and they were kept growing and selling more and more Android phones, the tail started wagging the dog, as it were, and they were pretty much driving what happened with Android.
Yeah.
Google started to fight back because they didn't want to lose control of their baby. And Samsung was like, well, if you don't play ball with us, we'll just go take our ball and play somewhere else.
Mm.
And so they developed Tizen, which is their own operating system. And as of Monday, they've officially postponed their first Tizen phone launch. And they have put on the calendar that they are postponing it from this year to never. It's never coming. They've postponed
Ooh.
It indefinitely.
That was a juicy story that you wish happened. By the way, total sidetrack, and then we'll get back to this. I was reading Wired Magazine, which, by the way, I continue to get the actual paper magazine subscription.
Oh, baby.
I have pretty much ignored it for the last 8 months. But for whatever reason, I picked it up this month, and it was fantastic. So I'll probably start reading it again. And
their articles are just so long. Ugh.
I'm just saying. But one of them, which I really liked, because it was talking about you know, I was reading about Guardians of the Galaxy, trying to figure out what was good about it. But then they were also talking about other movies and all these remakes. And this guy was like, why are we remaking awesome movies that just are classics and should be left alone? He was primarily disgusted with the new Turtles movie that's going to come out.
Right.
And he's like, the 90s version was fine. Why must we do this? And then he was like, Dumb and Dumber 2? Dumb and Dumber was fine. Why? Which, by the way, the trailer for that was hilarious. And
yeah.
I don't know if I'll go see it in theaters, but I'll watch it when it comes out on Netflix for sure.
I'm going to watch Dumb and Dumber 7 more times, though, because of that movie, which I think that's the real point. But yeah, continue.
Yeah, which is hilarious. Which, by the way, Jesse and I watched Dumber and Dumber while taking a road trip to Colorado.
That's awesome.
anyways, but what I – so anyways, he was talking about all these different
– You couldn't get any dumber. You go and do something like this and completely redeem yourself. that's such a great movie.
It is great. So, you know, and he rattled off a whole bunch of movies. He's like, what's with all the Spider-Man redos and, you know, why do we have to keep redoing this? He was like, here's an idea. What if we tried to remake those movies that should have been awesome, but turned out they weren't?
Oh, interesting.
Let's take another stab at those. Because he's like, those ones were already great. Let's put them on the shelves and celebrate them, and we'll just rewatch them when we're looking for a good movie. Let's try to redeem ourselves on some of those other ones.
I know the answer to this question, and it's super frustrating.
Yeah, I know.
You can't get out of it, but the simple truth is they make more money adjusted for inflation per blockbuster, and they make more blockbusters, you know, per summer than they ever have before. And the reason is because they go with the tried and true. And it's like people who complain about the fact that there's no originality in movies anymore. And you look like Edge of Tomorrow. An amazing movie, probably one of the best science fictions this summer. And
that's Tom Cruise on it, right?
Yeah, and it got demolished by comic adaptations.
Really?
It's getting killed by everything. It actually did pretty good abroad. It did very well abroad, which is going to save it. But domestically, it didn't do great. But it's like, you know, a reboot of the Monkey movie, a comic book adaptations. Like, all of these, like, you know, just these movies don't make it because they're not tried and true. Like, and the Chris Nolan, what's it called? Interstellar. The only reason why that one's going to make, if it succeeds, the only reason it's going to succeed is because it's Christopher Nolan and he did the Batman, you know, adaptations. And you just, like, it's funny. I'm actually a big fan of the idea of write a book, turn it into a comic book, turn it into a movie. Let it get a fan base going, let people get interested about it, and then, you know, and then get really mass appeal with movies. I don't have any moral problem with them doing that. But the reboots, yeah, especially, like, and it's funny, that's what I keep coming back to with the Turtle movie. I can't do the Turtle movie. I'm not going to be able to watch it. Because, number one, I was too young to watch the Ninja Turtles when they were super popular in cartoons. Our parents stopped us from watching them. Exactly. Well, ironically, they let me watch Power Rangers. I never got that. Like, couldn't do G.I. Joe, couldn't do Ninja Turtles, but sure, Power Rangers are fine. Real people hitting things, that's cool.
Which, by the way, apparently, and I didn't know this because we never watched it, no one actually dies in G.I. Joe. How about that?
That makes sense.
Community had to do the spoof on that for me to learn that.
That actually makes sense. That was the worst part about Saturday morning cartoons. I remember that bugging me so much when I was young, and it only bugs me more now when characters never die. Like, characters have to die occasionally. Like, just kill them. And it's the biggest problem with Joss Whedon. That's what makes me so nervous about the Avengers movies and him doing the Avengers movies. He's going to kill people and just bring them back and kill people and bring them. Oh, guess what? They weren't dead. No, Joss, they were dead. You leave them dead. That's how you make good shows.
You can't kill Coulson, come on.
What?
Coulson.
Oh my gosh, exactly. That is such a Joss Whedon thing to do. Like, you like this super emotional death of a character, and then
it's classic.
You do a TV show of, oh yeah, guys, he was alive the whole time. That ruins it. That honestly ruins. That doesn't make me feel good. That makes me feel terrible. They had this giant war, and it was completely point. I mean, oh, whatever. Okay. Anyways,
wow. I was not expecting that. Awesome.
I love everything that Joss Whedon does except that. How do we get on this topic? Oh yeah, but it's just a trident. It's all a proving grounds. We're the problem. It's kind of like we get the government we deserve, you know, because we voted for him. But it's the same thing. You want to know why there's no originality in Hollywood? Because it doesn't pay to do it. Because we don't want to see bad movies. Bad movies left a bad taste in our mouth. So we don't care how good the new version is. We're gonna say, well, wasn't that a bad movie? Yeah. Yeah, and oftentimes they take good movies and reboot them, and they're bad. It can go both ways, but whatever.
Which is why Samsung is sticking with the tried and true.
Wow, my guess. Thank you for bringing that back around, because I completely forgot how we got there. So yeah, they're skipping the ties, and the biggest problem is that they didn't do what I said they should have done, which is built a virtual machine that would run Android apps, just steal all of Android, really steal Android's cake, until developers made native Tizen apps. But, you know, Samsung has some limit to the amount of copy and paste that they're willing to do. That was inflammatory. I was mean. But, yeah, Tizen's done. It's over. Take that out of the oven. So.
Okay.
That's fun. Your turn.
Oh.
That's all I have to say on that.
Kind of big news. I don't know. You have to tell me if this is bigger news or not.
Okay.
Zillow is acquiring Trulia for like $2.5 billion in stock, which is significantly more than either of them actually made last year. Technically, they both lost money last year. So,
technically,
there's that. But yeah, so Zillow. Which I love cool Zillow, by the way.
Yeah.
I love Zillow. You can look up home values anywhere, and they have a Zestimate, which is the Zillow version of a home estimate. They'll tell you stats about it. If there's pictures, they'll add pictures. There's a map. They'll tell you what they think it would rent for with a point estimate and a range, and I appreciate that statistical confidencing that they do. They will tell you about history, price history, either changes, sales, foreclosures, whatever. They will add all that. They have a fun little mortgage calculator in there so you can figure out what your payments would be. And then they also link to the original data sources, which is fun. You can also look up citywide stats for pricing trends over time.
Nice.
Pretty sweet. Zillow also has can you tell I spent a little bit of time on this website?
Yes.
They have an app which can do location-based stuff. So if you're like walking around town, and we've done this before, like be walking on the beach and we look at some house and I go, oh my gosh, that house has to be worth at least $5 million. And Jesse will go, I actually think it's only worth $3 billion. You can solve that debate.
That's the extent that I use it, but I use it on a semi-regular basis. You'll be like, you'll see some house at the top of a hill in San Francisco with a beautiful view, and that's going to be a $10 million house. Oh, I'll bet it's only worth $2 million. And then, yeah, like you said, settle the debate.
Yeah. Let's just 20.
Yeah, actually, you know, I'll be honest. I'm actually – there's a price cap in for actual houses in San Francisco.
Really?
Yeah, they're 10 mil is really kind of the upper range. There's not – I've only seen one or two $12 million homes. I don't know if, you know, you get obviously anything bigger than a home is.
Yeah, right. Right. Multifamilies are a different deal.
I think because the view, how much is a view worth? I think is the question at that point.
Worth about $9.5 million.
Pretty much. And then, yeah, because it's not until you get into like Mountain View and Los Altos that you get the $50 million homes, like the really ridiculous ones where they're on top of – because those ones, they put you on top of a mountain. You're the only one there, and you've got a view of San Francisco from the other side of the bay, which is why.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So so these apps are cool.
They are cool.
So and Zillow has some other stuff where you can do some interior decorating stuff. You can list rentals and blah, blah, blah. Trulia – is kind of the number two dog in this space, doing pretty much the exact same thing. And there's some others out there, like Redfin is another popular one that, shows prices. Realtors, for the most part, hate it. Or will go, oh, it's inaccurate, you can't use that. That's the reason why.
Is it only because it takes their job?
Well, so that's the big question. And what I kind of want to float by you here is, you know, the big implication to all of this is like, oh, man, the two big ones ganging up. Realtors better look out now, yo. You're going down. You're going down like Amazon took down Barnes & Noble. And Borders. There we go. Yikes. You know, that's the instant. That is the simile, the metaphor. I don't forget the comparison that everyone's using. They're like, yeah, this is Zillow is the new Amazon, and they're taking them down. Apparently, the issue being A, they're losing money, which Amazon lost money for a really long time. Zillow doesn't actually sell real estate, so that's a little bit different than Amazon. Yeah. Right now, they get a lot of their money by realtors advertising their services to people looking at homes.
Yeah, I don't think the realtor goes away. I think it's a big enough purchase and it's a big enough deal that you need a highly educated person to act, you know, somebody who it's their job to help people make, you know, that decision. I'll use myself as an example.
Though, I will just throw out a small counter to that. Last Friday, Jesse and I walked through a house that we were looking at, because it was interesting. And
you just can't stop, can you?
No. Well, it was in Corvallis, South Town, and it was a decent price, and it was very similar to our current home. And HP is actually changing their policy on working from home to working less from home, less from home. Yeah, and so I was kind of like, let's look at places that are closer to work. And so anyways, so we were looking at it. But there was a couple that was ahead of us, and so we kind of had to wait. And they were there for like 20 minutes maybe. And I don't know if in that 20 minutes they decided that wasn't what they wanted, and so they were out or whatever. But I was just kind of laughing. I was like, holy cow, man, this for some people, this is the biggest purchase they will ever make. And it's like, yeah, we'll walk through it for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever. We'll make a decision. Or it's like, buying a television can take like 2 hours.
Yeah.
But yeah. I don't know. Maybe it's easier to wrap your head around.
That's what I'm going to say. I think the problem is that, yeah, television, cars. I think cars, you start to tip the scale towards that. It's such a big decision, and it's so complicated and so technical. Like, a lot of people just don't even know where to start. Like, does it have radio? How does the AC work? Is it fun to drive? Is it pretty? You know, you ask questions like that, and you're like, those are, like, the last things that you should be worrying about, but they're the primary things that people worry about, you know? It's like the classic example. GM makes some of the best sound systems, stock sound systems out there. There's my personal opinion, unless you're really, really, really crazy, there's absolutely no reason to upgrade any GM sound system, because they're all really good. And the reason for it is because they sell cars. Has nothing to do with cars. It's really cheap to upgrade one. But they've realized that if they put in a good sounding quality sound system where you can really turn the beats up and get some good quality sound going on a test drive, people are going to buy cars based on that. Because we buy cars based on stupid stuff. And houses are the same way. Is it cute
from
the
outside? That's an interesting insight, by the way.
Is it? Thank you. You know, is it cute from the inside? Is it one of the great examples with houses? Is it's like you never want to have a house. You want to have the house staged, right? You don't want it to be cluttered, but you want furniture there, because if it's too cluttered, if it's cluttered, people go, oh, there's no space. They can't think around, oh, I have to paint this room or I have to redo this carpet. Even though it'll save them a ton of money, they want everything done. They're not going to be able to imagine it. It's like, I think there's just a real – it's all about education. It's all about education. You're just not familiar with it, so it's all overwhelming. And, you know, if you've ever tried to explain what you do to somebody who has no idea what you do and no real care, you talk to them for 5 minutes and they're just like – they go glossy eye, and if you're lucky, they'll tell you, look, I don't care. and you're so frustrated because you're like, this is the most important thing. It happened to me yesterday. I have a friend who's an engineer, who's a graphic artist, who likes graphic artist engineer, who works in the tech industry and likes tech stuff. And I was trying to explain to him how diodes and transistors work and how, like, what it is I do for a living, and just didn't care at all. And it was hard. I mean, like, I could tell he was trying to care, but it's like you sit there and go, like, this is literally one of the most important parts of what you do. And it's a foundational thing, and you just don't care because you don't have to. And a lot of people, that's how they treat houses, man. You just like, it, you know, you don't know what you don't know. And so you just sort of let somebody walk you through it, which is why I think having somebody there is important, you know. And it's like, for me, I would feel more comfortable looking at a house and spending a long time, you know, checking out the house and learning more about it. But I don't really know the finance side of it. I, you know, it's like, how is this, how, what paper do I have to, what, you know, what legal documents do I have to sign? I don't have any idea. I'm going to want somebody there to help me. And so even though I'll probably use Zillow to sort of get a sense and to kind of fact check a realtor, you know, it's, you know, and I would say this, this is probably what the most accurate correlation I could give is it'll be the relationship between Zillow and real estate agents will be much the same that you'll have between WebMD and doctors.
Mm.
You're not going to make any final decisions generally without the doctor, but you're going to be well educated on what you think the problem is when you go in, and you'll probably
right.
be You'll probably, or I should say, you'll be very well informed, but you'll probably be largely misinformed, and it will change the nature of the relationship because now the real estate agent's job is to understand what your biases are walking in and then cater to your biases, as opposed to like a doctor. What do you think you have, and then we'll just treat you for what you think you have, you know, as safely as possible, unless it's an emergency. You know, oh, you think you've got an infection? Okay, we'll give you antibiotics. Why not? It's not going to kill you. It might help breed a super bug that will eventually wipe out humanity, but hey, you know, it's like 10 years from now that we got to worry about that.
Or may it cause your death in the future because you're now immune to that particular...
Yeah.
No, that makes sense. That it could become that. I guess, so perhaps a more interesting question is, what would it take for the realtors to have to run scared? For that industry to just implode like the book industry or the newspaper industry, perhaps. Though I think book is a better. I mean, obviously somehow Zillow would have to get into the transaction game, right? Kind of get like contracted realtors working for them.
I know. They'd have to figure out some new way to do it that gets around legal precedents that protect the real estate agent industry. Much the same way that Uber and Lyft are doing now, where they basically they're competing directly with the taxi services, but they're not taxis. And that's really disrupting the taxi industry.
They're agents, but not agents.
Yeah.
Some sort.
Yeah. Or, you know, it's kind of like the whole LegalZoom thing, you know, it's we're going to give you everything you need for two parties to do it without a third party. We'll automate the whole process and we'll just make it super easy and we'll give you all the information that you need. And I still think, you know, they'll still be, it's kind of like insurance companies, the same deal.
Maybe it's they take over the escrow spot, not the agent spot. Interesting.
Yeah.
So an escrow agent is the person who is that third-party trusted organization that will make sure all the documents are executed properly and will hold all the money and transfer everything appropriately. And they typically will also do title search for you to make sure the person selling the property actually has the rights to sell the property.
Which is nice of them.
And so, yeah, which you might be surprised sometimes.
I was going to say, I've read stories about that where like they had to buy the house from the person that – actually owned it, because that's the whole title search thing, right? Is they're they're guaranteeing that the person selling it actually owns it. So if they're wrong, they have to buy the house from, if the owner doesn't want to sell it to the person who thinks they're the owner, then they have to buy it from the person that thinks they're the owner, and vice versa. If the owner says, you know what, that's crazy. It's craziness.
So all that to say, I could very well see where Zillow's got a system set up that kind of does auto blanks and whatever, and you kind of eBay style submit a bid and say, oh, I'll buy it for this much, these terms, you know, by selecting sliders and whatever. You do some sort of e-signature thing and it submits it to the seller, and if they agree, they go, sweet. And then Zillow handles that transaction from an automated you know, standpoint of sending out emails and whatever. And if you want to have your own agent representative, you can, but you don't have to either.
Yeah. Which I think
I could see something like that.
I could see, yeah, I could see that. I think it'll be similar to like car insurance and insurance in general, where there will still be agents and they'll still be pounding.
What if it's like an agent call center type thing? You can call in and, you know, I'm thinking, you know, think like Geico or some of the bigger ones that don't have individual agents.
Yeah.
And they look up your stuff and your property and they tell you, okay, here's what you got going on. You know, quasi give you advice, or I don't know, advice is maybe not the right word. That would be an interesting system.
Yeah.
It's weird without physical things, but, you know, I guess they do it for car insurance. Maybe that's an even better analogy. Agents will still exist. That model will still be there, but those guys, because they will be cheaper. And that's what Zillow will do. They'll say 2% commission or whatever.
Yeah.
You know.
And they'll
a flat fee.
And like you said, they'll just hire agents. They'll let them be private. Private contract employees and stuff. So you handle all your own, you know, taxes and whatnot. Like a lot of the, you know, which is kind of the direction that they're going with a lot of IT stuff. And for 104.9, no, that's a radio station. 1049s. What's the whatever that tax filing and your private contract stuff. And just let them move in that direction. And yeah, it's less personalized, but it's highly automated, so it's highly accurate and easy to use.
Yeah, interesting. That could be cool.
Yeah. It could be cool. I think there's potential there for some serious disruption, but I think we're still a couple years away from it. Because technologically, I think it's very easy. I think, but you're fighting cultures, you know,
laws, yeah,
and laws, which is, you know, the slowest moving of all. The, you know, cultures will move fast if the setting is right. You know, it's laws that can take a long time to tax. Once again, tax is a perfect example. It's, you know, the culture is shifting incredibly quickly, but the laws are the only thing that's, you know, causing any form of a stumbling block. So, yep. So did you hear about bad USB?
No.
As a reader of Wired, I'm surprised. Because they had a big article this week. This is huge news for anybody who's into security stuff. Because, you know, the idea of how do you pass around viruses, there's all sorts of different ways, right? And how do you compromise a machine? One of the classic virus is I should say, it's hard to define what a virus is, but there's these different categories. Like there's the Trojan, right? So you download Photoshop, you download an illegal version of Photoshop, and it's got embedded software in it that comes along, piggybacks it, Trojan horses, into your computer. You download it, you actively install it. A classic virus would be a program that's called Photoshop.exe. That's not actually Photoshop at all. It's just a virus. It's just malware of some form. That's like, and it requires you to actively download it. Then there's types that are going to attack your computer directly and try to get in through different means. Then there's worms, which are kind of terrifying because the whole point of a worm is that it will look for a vulnerable internet port and it will access your computer. It'll get into your computer by doing Stack Overflows. Generally is how they get into your system, and they will implant the virus without you actively doing anything. So there's nothing that you can do to be careful enough to not get a worm. They're self-replicating and self-perpetuating, and generally what they do is they open up a portal. They open up a, you know, some sort of an access point so that, like a chimney for Santa Claus, that later on other malware can come in or turn you into a botnet, stuff like that. So those are your kind of classic viruses. And then, but a lot of, like, one of the big principles of security is that the internet is easy to protect against compared to somebody actually getting access to your computer. Because the moment somebody has physical access to your computer, it's all bets are off. Like, anybody can do anything. And so the USB is one of the classic transmission points for viruses. So what you would do is you'd put a little executable on the USB. You plug it into somebody's computer, it automatically jump onto the computer. It's the nature of the protocol of how the universal serial bus works with these thumb drives. It'll look at what's going on in there, and it'll just take that, and then it'll start to execute it. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, as floppy disks went away, the USB very quickly replaced the floppy disk as the system driver. It's directly wired to your BIOS, so like you could put like operating systems and stuff on that. So just it's part of the nature of how the protocol works. So you got to be safe. So most virus software will do a scan of USB drives and look for viruses and stuff on them before you plug it. You know, as soon as you plug it in, and it won't let it execute. And then you know, just general good safe practice with USB is to regularly reformat your USB sticks so that nobody can put viruses on it. Well, officially, that whole principle of how USB is to be protected, completely useless. Because, cool. Yeah, it's pretty awesome. So this organization, what they did was they wrote a virus, and they took a little bit of a different tact when it came to their USB thumb drives. Instead of loading this virus into the USB into the memory, into the storage of the USB thumb drive, what they did is they baked it into the drivers. And so if you've ever plugged a new USB into your computer, obviously it starts to automatically detect the drivers and look at it and will download that stuff and so that it can communicate with the USB. And this is like a completely open protection. Like there's like no – as soon as you plug it in, the assumption is you trust this device. And so Windows, Apple, nobody looks at it and goes – hey, we got to be, you know, we should be careful about this. And basically, it's like it is all bets are off. And so they're taking advantage of this now to inject whatever malware, whatever code they want into your computer. Once again,
how do they get the code onto the USB stick?
They're writing their own drivers. So they take the drivers that are on the USB stick that's embedded into the firmware of the hardware. And then
selling these USB sticks on eBay or something, or
well, yeah, they could. Well, this is actually a securities firm, so they wrote this virus and they're showing it at the big black hat convention right now.
Yeah,
it's not technically been released into the wild, but you know who knows at this point. So
I'm just thinking, like, so a hacker would have to somehow get a hold of your USB stick.
See, now that's the fun part. Because they figured out a way, since it's kind of all you've got a trusted computer and a trusted USB stick. Turns out a lot of those communications go both ways. And so they're talking about the fact that it's possible to inject code onto a computer that will then look at the next USB stick and jump onto that. But it gets worse. Because the particular nature of the protocol is not inherently exclusive to thumb drives. It's the universal serial bus. So your microphones, your joysticks, your keyboards, your mice, your Bluetooth dongles, all of these things are vulnerable to this particular type of malware, which is kind of horrifying.
So again, how does the malware get onto your computer? So they can get onto that other thing.
They're talking about how it's coming on through the USB. There's firmware. So there's two separate memory sections.
Do you understand what I'm asking? You're not answering the question I'm asking. Like, okay, fine. They can infect my mouse. So what? They're never going to get a hold of my mouse.
So basically, okay, I see what you're saying. Well, see, that's the trick. So now, yeah, if they never get a hold of your mouse, you're fine. But there's two ways. So if they got a hold of – if somebody physically got a hold of your mouse, put it onto a different computer, and then gave you your mouse back, then you would be vulnerable, right? That makes sense?
Right.
So the question is there's two different ways for it to happen.
Unless I punch them in the face, in which case we're okay.
Exactly. The USB drive, and this is why the jump drive is so is the big contender here, is because this is like the universal way to pass large chunks of data, right? You're moving stuff really quickly. You just want to jump from computer to computer. Most viruses have gone over that means. But the idea and why it's important to know that your mice and your keyboard are vulnerable too is because the NSA has – what they'll do is Logitech will design a new keyboard, right? And they'll send all those plans over to China. China will manufacture. They'll put everything together. And then what the NSA will do is they'll go into the Chinese factory and say, hey, BT Dubs, we're going to take the firmware. We're going to give you firmware 1.1 and $10,000, and you're going to upload all these mice with firmware 1.1 for us. And that's how most malware is getting on to embedded systems coming from the factory, which is there's a lot of that going on, and it's generally the NSA or MI6 or whatever China's version of their intelligence agencies. That's where a lot of that factory default malware comes from. But that's why it's important, is because it can now come on anything. It's not just USB sticks, but they're also talking about one of the big problems here is that there's not any way to really verify this type of firmware. There's no method in place. Like, you can't post it online and say, check against this. There's just no way to do that. And there's nothing inherent in how operating systems treat this kind of stuff to actually, because this is all considered a zero day flaw. And one of the biggest differences between Linux and Unix and Windows is how they treat inquiries from the internet. Basically, when an inquiry comes in from the internet, Windows automatically gives it permission, whereas Unix, which is what Linux is based off, automatically doesn't give it permissions. Unix is considered inherently safe because unless I actively give it permission, it can't attack me. And so Linux, most Unix servers, Apple, that's why these things are considered inherently safe from internet attacks. Worms can't penetrate them like they can with Windows, because Windows automatically says yes and then has to take what information it's getting and figure out whether or not it should protect against it. And it's just been this fundamental difference in the operating systems that's been there forever, and it's what leaves Windows so vulnerable. And now evidently everybody is vulnerable to this. There's nothing. And they talk about the idea of the alternative is to treat the USB device like a hypodermic needle. They're basically like, at this point, USB devices in general aren't safe. You just have to assume that they're inherently not safe if you were trying to protect your computer from vulnerabilities. So never share your mice with anybody. Never share your keyboard with anybody. Never share your microphones with anybody. Never put it on anything else. Don't use USB drives. It's just that's the only way to assume that, you know, a hypodermic needle is you use it once and you never use it again. Oh, you only use it on yourself. You never share. And that's where we're at.
Okay. I'm not as concerned about it as you are.
Well, okay. That's good. I'm glad, James. Glad you can go through your life without any concerns like that.
I can. Pretty easily, actually. Pretty darn easily. All right.
All right, moving on. Never mind. I thought it was a big deal. Whatever. Tell me about fashion.
Yeah, let's talk about something that's a bigger deal, okay?
Oh, jeez.
That was the equivalent of the glossy "I don't care about diodes." Interaction, I guess.
Driving nuts.
I'm just, you know, proof of concept. They're going to be talking about it.
This stuff is proof of concept for 5 minutes before, as soon as there's a proof of concept and people know that it can be done, they figure out how to do it. I mean, it's
true.
Anyways, go for it.
All right. So HP announced a, I don't know. What did they announce? A smartwatch.
Yeah. That's awesome. Does it tell time?
I think so.
Nice.
It is, it's going to go on sale on the flash sales site Gilt for some reason. And they had an external designer named Michael Bastian from Fashionista help them with the design of it. And then HP is doing all the software.
Okay, cool.
Because HP is a software company.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I've always said about HP. Software, software, software.
Yep, that's what they do. So, we're being sarcastic, in case you couldn't figure that one out. So, apparently, they made these watches that all we have are pictures. At this point, there's no actual
device
watch,
right?
Other than a concept photo, which I'm fairly certain is shopped beyond shopped. And it doesn't run Android Wear, but some other things. So they're pretty sure it will sync with iOS and or Android. It'll send you your emails, your text notifications. You'll be able to control your music. You'll be able to check your weather, sports, stock price updates. It's a Pebble. Actually, I love this. It says, overall, it sounds like a slightly dumbed-down Pebble. is probably the best way to put it. But the emphasis here is that on it looks good as opposed to not looking good.
Yeah.
So we don't. There's no details on the type of screen or the type of battery or even, you know, the operating system and its total photo capabilities. But what we do know is that it has a 44-millimeter circular watch face.
And
the straps will be available in brown leather, green nylon, or black rubber, with a range of other different customization options. So I think it's interesting that they, in this TechCrunch article, they talked about being a leg up for over Android Wear alternatives, because it sounds like, you know, it could work for iOS. Which I think is weird because, I don't know, HP's kind of like thrown into the Android camp, so I'll actually be shocked if it works for iOS. But there's a part of me, and again, this gets back to the like cranky old man stance, where I'm like, so what? If anything, this is slightly concerning to me.
Yeah.
Because I feel like it should be Android Wear, and HP didn't make it that, because they're not a software company and they're slow as molasses when it comes to updating software and making it up to date. I feel like this is going to be one of those really good looking watches that no one uses because it's not usable.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's honestly what I think. And the reason why is because HP is going to try to hit a price point, because HP competes on price, except for in the printer world. And and so they're going to try to hit a price target, and therefore they will sacrifice on the software side, because that's what they're in charge of.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. I'm an idiot. That was uncomfortable. I would agree. I like the idea that it's got to be fashionable. I think that's one thing that a lot of companies have not done. That the Moto 360. You know, I think is the best looking of your different smartwatches. And I think that's absolutely necessary. I think that the round watch face is a really good move. I'm keeping my fingers crossed that Apple goes that way, because I think square and rectangular, and other ones are kind of ugly. But yeah, there's a whole package here that needs to be hit in order to get a succeeding product. It's not good enough to just have a good looking watch, because there's a lot of really good looking watches out there. It's not enough to have a couple of notifications, because you got your phone in your pocket. You don't need a couple of notifications. It's not, you know, right now the best selling wearables are all, you know, sensors. I'm holding up my my Fitbit. And I think that's because it offers you something different and new that your phone can't do for you. Now, if you couple that with the notifications and stuff like that, yeah, you start to really get some, you know, you start to hit a tipping point. You start to go someplace cool. But, I just think that anything that ignores the idea that it's got to have different sensors in it, and anything that but like you said, even more to the point, you know, it's the fact that they're ignoring, it's not Android Wear. Like, I like the fact that it'll work with iOS. I think that's promising, and I get why they would go that direction. But I think that, you know, at this point, I'm not super optimistic about this outside of it'll move the fashion aspect of it forward. Because I think that's really important, and I think that, you know, I think that just if you look at the watch industry, it's all about individuality and options when it comes to style. And so any smartphone or any smartwatch that ignores that aspect of it is going to fail. So it's like, it sounds like they've got one part of it going in the right direction, but like you said, they're all highly photoshopped. Super curated. Like, we don't actually know what it looks like on a wrist. We don't know if it looks good or not. We're just kind of sick. It's funny. I say, you know, it's fashion forward, because that's what the articles say, because that's what HP is saying. Like, I don't know that it's actually fashion forward. It might be ugly when you actually see it and all of a sudden done. And, you know, you just be like, really? This is what you've offered? But I don't know. I like the fact that they're throwing in. I like the fact that people are trying to come up with a solution, because it keeps moving it forward. But I doubt that this is it.
Here's the other issue that I have. Man, I hate to beat up on HP, but I care too much, you know. So this is a pre-announcement. For yes. The fall. Hopefully there's a little bit more meat to this coming up. But what I also know is that one of the VPs who was working on this gave a talk over a year ago about smartwatches and what they were doing and where they thought it would head. Over a year ago. And we're finally now just coming out with it. And we haven't even come out with it yet.
Yeah.
It's for later in the year. I don't know.
And it sounds like the only reason they're making this announcement is because Android Wear is taking off, and Android Wear, there's competitors out there now, and they want to freeze the market, you know, to save their little, what they hope to be their little piece of it. You know, like you say, it might just be vaporware, but it's intended to say, look, we're more, you know, if you're looking for a fashion statement, don't get the Moto 360. That's an ugly watch compared to our beautiful watch.
My problem, though, is HP clearly is a slow mover on this. And essentially what they just did for, I don't know, Samsung and others would say, hey, guys, here's the watch that you should design and kick out in the next 6 months and beat us to the punch.
Yeah.
I mean, that's literally what they just did.
Yeah.
Thanks for the free input.
Yeah.
I'm frustrated because I want HP to be successful. I want it to do better. I fundamentally believe it can do better, and it just isn't proving it, and it bugs me. And
yeah.
It's not just because my paycheck is tied to it.
I mean, yeah,
it's not really for this particular one.
Yeah.
But, man, I want it to be good, and it's not.
Yeah. No, I understand. I get it. I get it. I think, you know, I think you're harsher on it than I am, but I think it matters to you more than I do to me. And, yeah.
I really hope I'm wrong when they actually unveil it.
You won't be. It's not their specialty. You're talking about super low resource, you know, you're talking about super, yeah, that's the problem. It's got to be software that looks beautiful, that runs smooth on super low resources, and that's hard for any company. You know, there's two companies that have really succeeded at it, Apple and Google. And Google, not even as much as Apple, by and large. I mean, Apple's the only one that's really been stellar at, you know, really maximizing performance with low resources. And that started in 2000 with, you know, OS X. And because, oh, you know, Macs have always had lower specs than Windows. It's because they've always, and one of their big arguments is that, will we tie the software to the hardware so we can run with lower specs, which is true. I mean, it's, you know, it's a legitimate argument, but it's something they've practiced for a long time, building low resource intensive, you know, graphic stuff and processes so that they can run the same quality software on lighter weight hardware. And if it's hard to do, it's just hard to do. It's harder. You know, it's always easier to add more horsepower and bulkier, you know, slower code. That's the easy way to do it, and it's really difficult to do in that form factor, or it's not possible to do in that form factor. You know, another big question on all this is battery life. How does it charge? How long does it last? You know, a lot of times,
yeah,
it's got physical buttons. What are the physical buttons for? You know, it's clearly a Pebble competitor. It's clearly a beautiful Pebble competitor, is was the intention, and it probably will succeed at that. If you're looking for a Pebble competitor that's better looking, great. Mm-hmm. Problem is I think the Moto 360 has really leapfrogged the Pebble on software applicability and overall aesthetics. And I don't think that these leapfrogged past the Moto 360. And it's because HP's been working on it for a year, has been, you know, making incremental process, and they just, you know, they got kind of blindsided by Google, would be my guess. But
it's a good guess.
It's unfortunate. There are obviously smart people working there, but they claim that most of them are working on the next generation of servers, so maybe that's the problem, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Bigger, better ideas.
This next section, I think we should go back and forth between the two of us, and you should go first.
Okie dokie, artichokey. So I read a really interesting article on basically the idea of the devil's advocate and the 10th man theory.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen the movie World War Z?
I did.
So in that movie, they talk about this idea of why did Israel survive the zombie apocalypse? It's because they have...
Yes, MG Siegler should be my best friend. Just saying.
Oh, yeah. I know. I know. You're a big fan. But
his favorite movie?
Top Gun. Oh, nice. Which that was, you know.
His favorite computer game?
Command & Conquer? Oh, yeah. Those are good, too.
I'm just saying.
You're right.
There's a lot in common between him and I. It's actually kind of scary. We're similar age, too. I think he's like a year or two older than me.
Weird. Yeah. But that also explains a lot why you'd like the same things. So basically the idea was that Israel, specifically Jerusalem, survives the zombie apocalypse for a really long time. And the question is why? Why did they prepare for it when nobody else did? They built a bunch of walls and they did a bunch of things to protect themselves that get all undone when Brad Pitt shows up because, you know.
Shh, no spoilers.
Oh, right. It's a 2013 movie. Come on now.
I saw it like a month ago.
Oh, really? Okay. But the whole idea was that and this is like a legitimate thing in different organizations, including the Israeli armed forces. But it's this idea that if there's 10 people sitting in a room and 9 of them all agree on something, then it is the duty of the 10th person to disagree and to work against the other nine. So, and the whole idea of that is that, you know, it avoids groupthink. That somebody has to be the devil's advocate, just so that it doesn't get to the point where eight people agree and the last two just kind of go along, and then when it turns out to be the opposite, they go, well, I thought the rest of you agreed, so I just went with it. And what it does is it basically gives one person the ability to disagree and to act in, you know, to act as a fail-safe in complete, you know, clearance. It's basically everybody's agreeing one of us will be the outsider, and then that way we won't get mad at that person for being the outsider. We'll never have when you get all 10 people 100% vote. Well, no. When you get 100%,
yes,
no. When you get 100% vote on anything, it's consensus. You're never going to get a consensus. You're always going to have at least some portion of the group. It's their job to tear apart the idea and try to figure out a different way to do it. Why are we talking about World War Z? Well, it's because sometimes companies come out with products that seem like really obvious to everybody else was a terrible idea, yet somehow everybody inside the company thought it was a great idea. And M.G. Siegler, the writer of this article, is basically arguing that that's what happened with the Fire Phone. Got a bunch of people together who all had this idea, and it seemed like a good idea, and they all played with the phone, and it seems impossible that the rest of us would look at the phone for 5 minutes and go, this is a stupid idea. And then that there weren't people, it seems impossible to believe that there weren't people inside the company that felt the same way. Yet for some reason, the phone launched and the product, you know, hit the shelves and it's being received that way. Now, I would argue that there's a good chance that they knew that it wasn't as great as they wanted it to be. And it's an iterative thing. It's the argument I made last week when the phone was launched. At least I'm consistent. I just thought it was a really interesting principle. And he comes up with a couple of examples of products like the Nexus Q or the Surface RT. And he's basically talking about, like, these products that just fail completely. How is it that people don't – how is it that companies push out these products that are just terrible ideas in retrospect? And part of it is that nobody – in future spect, try to there's an actual word there, and I don't know what it is. The antonym of retrospect. There's nobody trying to say this is a bad idea. And he talks about the idea that, you know, the nice part about working at Apple under Steve Jobs. There we go. The nice part about working at Apple under Steve Jobs was the devil's advocate. The guy that said every product was awful, that saw all the flaws in everything, even saw the flaws in the most brilliant of their products, was the guy at the very head. He was impossible to impress, was Steve Jobs. He was the guy. He was the naysayer. You know, and the classic Apple quote is, it's, you know, our ability is not the ability to say yes to a great product. It's the ability to say no to great products, or to say no to good products, and wait for the great ones. You know, it's that that was what they, you know, and that's what their argument would be, is that the Fire Phone is a good product and somebody should have said no. And because it's not a great product and it could have been great. Whereas, you know, the iPhone, they would argue, was a great product, especially at the time. You know, it seems a little bit silly and outdated today, but it happened 6 years later. So I don't know. It's interesting. It's one of those things that I'm going to have that, you know, it's kind of a bigger thought piece for just the, how the industry runs in general. And so in my own personal life of really trying to be the devil's advocate and ask, is this idea exciting? And that's why I think it's a great idea. Or is it really a great idea? And saying no to a lot of good ideas and while you wait around and work towards coming up with a great idea. But
so the real question is, are you going to implement this in your dating life?
Probably not.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
and the reason, my guess, is there's a lot more on the line there than just trying to decide if a product's cool or not.
No, right? I'll be totally honest. I fight the other direction. I tend to be the devil's advocate in most of this stuff and just be like, this is stupid. I know where this is going to go, and it's not going to end. There's no clear path to victory, so I'm not even going to try. And which is really dumb, because usually when I thought there was a clear path to victory, it was a little, you know, there was a clear path and I managed to take the wrong one. You know, so it's like I sit there and I go, I tend to actually exercise too much discernment when I'm deciding. Hey, today, oh my gosh, it happened to me today. It was just like, you know, we talk about the fear of missing out versus the fear of rejection and failure. Sam, or for Amazon, the fear of missing out on the smartphone boat overcame their fear of failure, which can be cool if you got a product that's going to succeed. If you got a product that's going to fail, it's going to cost you a lot of money. And today I was sitting in a sushi restaurant with one of the prettiest girls I've probably ever seen in my entire life serving us, and decided, nah, it's a bad idea. She's a server. She's working here. Like, you know, I'm not going to bother her. What would it have cost anybody, me, her, or otherwise, for me to say, hey, can I get you your number, and then have her give me the wrong number? Like, honestly, it doesn't make any sense why we make these decisions. But in the dating life, it's very easy to be your own devil's advocate. And I do that very well. I don't want to brag too much as I brush my own shoulder off, but I turn away enough good girls that aren't, you know, that just,
Well, and I guess it's more for the later stages. You know, it's Amazon did throw off a lot of ideas at the beginning stages, and that was easy. What do you do when you're a year in, 2 years in? You know, and that's the position that they found themselves in, was, man, we've been working on this for 2 years, and they convinced themselves that it was good. I don't know. I just
Well, and I would say
I was just trying to find something that's important and meaningful to you, that, you know, does require those little decisions, because that's what it's like for them.
Yeah.
You know, for some poor product manager and team, you know, a no-go means I got to find something new to do with my time.
I would say this. The fact that Steve Jobs canceled product launches at the last minute as often as he did is important. And the fact that he didn't, you know, part of the reason why Apple is so secretive and they never do vaporware is because of how often they would at the last minute say this product's not ready and not launch it, because there was no momentum behind it outside of the company, so there was no expectation for it, so they could just kill
the product. Amazon has.
Right. And the thing is I would say this, as somebody who was engaged for 8 months, yeah, sometimes you just got to say, you know what? This is really not a good idea. This is really, maybe we should not do this. And, and it's terrible. It is rough. But you have to. Like, what are you going to do? Get married instead? Like, the relationship's not working. The phone's not going to sell. So you launch the phone anyway, so you get married anyways, because maybe that'll fix it. Like, no. And that's the tough part, is somebody has to sit there and say, I wouldn't buy this. I want people to buy this, but I wouldn't. And that's the real, you know, that's the real measuring stick, right? If I were my full optimistic self and I wasn't fully invested in this relationship, if I was somebody else, would I recommend this marriage? And, you know, which is why we don't ask our friends and family when you're in a bad relationship, or, you know, you're not completely honest about it, because you don't want to know the answer, you know, and that's how you keep moving forward. Amazon didn't want to know the answer. You know, and I think they convinced themselves, and I don't think that, I stand by what I said last week. I think they convinced themselves that this was a bad phone, but it was a first step and it'll get better. And I don't think that's a completely flawed perspective, but I do think that they could have done better and should have done better. And it's because nobody was willing to say no, because they were so far in, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough.
Your turn.
The NFL has come out with an idea that I think everybody, even the devil's advocate, should like.
Yeah.
They're going to put RFIDs on in the shoulder pads of players.
I like that.
So they can get better real-time stats of where these guys are. Sounds kind of awesome if they do it right. Which, the NFL is pretty good about doing it right with that kind of stuff. So I'm excited to see what they do.
Whoa.
So essentially they got these RFIDs inside of their shoulder pads, and then they have sensors all over stadiums, and there's going to be 15 stadiums that host Thursday night football games.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see here. San Francisco's on that list.
Levi Stadium, oh baby. Dude, okay, so, this is only tangentially related. I bought two pairs of Levi jeans from a Levi store, $42 after tax. Continue. I'm just really excited about that.
That's a good price, right?
Thank you. It's a great price. You buy Levi's from a Levi store, two pairs will walk out and it'll cost you $160. I mean, the stores are ridiculous. It's not Mervin's. But they got every style, and they all the right the different materials and the different colors and the different sizes and all the different fits. So you get like the perfect pair of jeans, but they're, you know, you pay for it. Anyways.
So this is so players and coaches and fans can get real-time stats while the game is in play. So it's going to be used a little bit different than other real-time tracking. Like soccer and basketball, which uses cameras to track the players, and it calculates based on, you know, visual tracking.
Right.
Which kind of makes sense because people get piled up.
Yeah.
A little bit more than soccer and basketball.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
I was going to say, I know with the balls, it's always been complicated with the balls. Like, the first place where they did tracking was with hockey because embedding a chip in the hockey puck was very easy because it didn't change the dynamics of the puck. They could put it right in the center, the balance and weight stayed the same, and the squishiness stayed the same. All the different physical aspects of it, you couldn't tell as a hockey player. It didn't materially affect the play. But with a basketball and especially a soccer ball, there's nowhere to put a computer chip. There's no place to put a tag, so when you had to figure out a different way to track it. So, like, I know that at FIFA, the big deal was all the different goals had, like, 8 different cameras that were looking at the goal so they could know exactly when the ball went in. Whereas the nice part about pads, you put a pair of tags in the pads, and it doesn't materially affect the play at all. And it gives you a more accurate, you know, view of what's going on the field.
So what'll be really interesting, in my opinion, is, you know, there's a part of me that wishes, like, I could somehow get into the sports stats arena. My problem is I'd have trouble picking a sport to do it in. Because I'm kind of like, there's testable theories here. Like, is it better to have a tired starter player or a fresh secondary player? And you'll actually be able to like track their speeds and, you know, and get a whole bunch more stats on their playing. And you may see more substituting happening, or you may see a lot less. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And they're going to get like a whole lot more, I would say, precise. You know, like one of the things that it says in the bottom of the article is, you know, you may not do Hail Mary passes anymore just because they'll have a clear sense of the statistical futility of that effort, you know, versus the potential for an injury or something. But it's like, you will see a lot smarter situational football happening.
Well, you say that, but at the same time, it's been known for quite a few years that you're better off to go for it on fourth down than punt. Statistically, you're more likely to score a touchdown than stop them from scoring a touchdown if you go for it. But everybody in the stands, all the commentators, it's such, quote, common knowledge that if you're not very close on fourth, if you're not better, you know, in the end, teams that went for it on fourth tend to win more than teams that punt. And yet, teams punt all the time because the conventional wisdom is that you're supposed to punt. And so sometimes, like, the coaches feel a lot of pressure, even from the club themselves, even though they can statistically prove that, no, it's better for us to go to try it on fourth, you know, especially within certain circumstances. Even though they can prove it, it goes against such conventional wisdom that they realize they're a TV show and they can't, you know, upset everybody. They can't look like idiots, you know, even though they're right.
I understand, and I think it'll have its Moneyball moment where you will get a coach, especially with all the numbers and the tracking, because football has decidedly less stats than, say, baseball.
Yeah.
And so, sure, there's that one level of stats to back it up, but there's that whole next level of data that's going to start coming in that you'll get that one coach who says, all right, we're going to try this. We're going to trust the data because we're sick and tired of losing every single year and not going to the Super Bowl. So why not?
Yeah, Lions, that's all you guys. You guys, you're perfect. Get ready for it. That was brutal for all of our Michigan fans. Sorry about that. except all of our Michigan fans know it's true. But
anyways, should be cool.
Yeah, that is cool. I like that idea. I agree with you. I was going to bring up the Moneyball thing of,
and it's not necessarily this season. It'll be like next season.
Yeah.
I mean, they're tracking this season.
I am surprised that there aren't more like force sensors and heart rate sensors and different. There's not, you know, that players aren't more quantified. There's so much money. You'd think you could afford to build that kind of stuff in. You know, accelerometer data into helmets would be really interesting to measure, except that's probably data they don't want to know when it comes to helmets. How hard are we actually getting hit in the head? So EA made an announcement, EA and Xbox. You got your Xbox One, and you want to play year-old video games, unlimited Euro video games, we have a solution for you. $30 a year, which is a pretty good price, I thought. EA will give you access to a bunch of last year's titles, basically. So, like, all the old Battlefields, the old Maddens, the old NBAs, all, like, basically their whole catalog of games that are like a year old. You get it. You can download them and play them on your Xbox One, which is pretty cool. And they also give you early access to the current games, so with, you know, saved data. So basically, like, a week before Titanfall comes out or whatever. They didn't make Titanfall, but, you know, a week before Call of Duty comes out, you can download the new Call of Duty, you can play it, and when the game launches, you can either choose to buy it or not. But you'll save the data. So it's kind of a cool service, I thought. Kind of moving in that direction, but what I thought, the reason I wanted to mention it is because, like, 3 days later, or even less than that, everybody was like, Sony, so are you jealous of Xbox? Pretty sweet deal, huh? And Sony was like, they came to us with that deal too, and we didn't think it was worth the cost, so we said no. Which is pretty brutal. That's pretty brutal. Pretty brutal rebuke. So, yeah. Turns out, you know, I don't know if it's a good deal or not. I thought it was a good deal. If I had an Xbox One, I would totally go for it. And since I'm gonna own a PlayStation 4,
it wasn't a good deal for Sony or Xbox. That's the issue.
Yeah. Wait, what?
So Sony wasn't, when they said it wasn't a good deal, they were referring to themselves, not to customers. And here's why I think that.
Okay.
Because the article I was going to talk about was Sony did unveil their PlayStation Now.
Yeah.
Later on in the week, it was like 2 days later, I guess. And for them, they're doing essentially game stream rentals.
Oh, I see.
And so you could, and their whole caveat is it's super cool for a price. So the idea is you rent a game and you play the game over the internet. And so it's actually running on a Sony server. When you press a button, it goes over to the Sony server, tells the computer what to do, and then sends it back to your television. Right? Online gaming. And this guy who was trying it, Ross Miller of The Verge, says, hey, worked great. Worked great at the office. Worked great at home. We even tried to break it by streaming a bunch of stuff on Netflix. And, you know, for the most part, it worked well.
Yeah.
Saying, though, some titles cost, polygons. What is this? The cost of rentals can be absurdly high for years-old games. Some titles cost as much as $5 for 4 hours of play.
Whoa.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's like Final Fantasy VIII, which, 8-2? I don't know what that means. Costs $30 for 90 days of use. But it's only $20 to pick up a physical copy at GameStop and own forever.
Right.
So his point was that it's pretty cool, but they need to work on that business model and to make it a little bit more affordable, which is why my comment was, Sony said they passed up on the EA deal because it wasn't profitable enough for them and what they had in mind. And so they're doing their own thing, which seems to be at a much more expensive option.
I hate it when I'm not cynical enough and then somebody points at the more cynical argument, and as soon as they do, I just have to like swallow my pride and go, you know what, you're right. I bought it because I'm an idiot and I was being a sunny optimist. I was like, no, Sony's the good guys in this battle. They're the ones looking out for the customers. But no, you're absolutely right. I feel like a bit of a moron at this point. So, good times.
It's all right. I think competition is good. And I do think it's interesting that it just tells you how rare it is to really take an industry by surprise, too. Because it's like, yeah, they made this announcement almost exact same time that Sony was doing their PlayStation Now announcement.
Yeah.
And it's like, the Nintendo Wii really did catch people by surprise. I don't think we give it quite enough credit for just how crazy of an idea and good idea that it was. You know, it's just like all these smartwatches, right? HP's like, oh, we're going to have a beautiful, awesome smartwatch. Oh, yeah, just before you announced that Android's coming out with their Android Wear, and now you got to pre-announce stuff because everyone else is coming out with stuff at the exact same time now.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's just rare to take everybody by surprise.
I remember the first time I noticed that was one summer, two Volcano movies came out the same summer. It was like Volcano LA and Mount Diablo or something like that. And the premise of both of them was there were these active volcanoes that nobody knew were volcanoes. One was James Bond was on a mountain, so it was kind of a more rural area, and the other one was obviously, you know, LA. It erupted in LA. The same basic premise where people were caught off guard by volcanoes erupting in the middle of highly populated areas. And I remember that just being really a profound idea to me at that young age, that why did two Volcano movies come out the same summer? Why would two competing studios, two competing groups of people come out with this idea? And it's like, and I started to realize and work through the idea that they all know each other, they all work with each other, and so somebody greenlit a Volcano movie that everybody was really excited about at Paramount, and so Warner Brothers was like, oh, we need a Volcano movie too. And so they greenlit their own Volcano movie, and everybody came out with a Volcano movie the same summer. And you're just like, why? Why did you do that? Like, how does that help anybody? You just, you know, basically it was Warner Bros. Didn't want Paramount to win the day, you know, like suck a little energy out of the room. And yeah, I completely agree with you, like on the whole idea of, you know, everybody knew that a computer company was getting into the smartphone race when Apple came out with the iPhone. You know, Google was in the middle of building their own software.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of different people were already in that market. What was surprising about it was, you know, battery life and the touchscreen. Like, the exact form factor of it was really startling to people. And you just don't give companies enough credit for that sort of when they succeeded, that sort of thing. And, you know, the Wii is another great example of that. It was just a really, man, that really changed how we, you know, thought about what a video game and, you know, that sort of an interaction would be. And, because it's interesting when the groupthink and everybody chasing the same, you know, everybody's trying to make a faster buggy. And,
yeah.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah, it is.
But.
I think you get to go again because I piggybacked on yours.
Okay, well, the deal is, so speaking of video games and the Nintendo Wii, the Wii U did not save the company. They launched, what's it called, Mario Kart, and tripled Wii U sales this last quarter, and they still posted a loss to Nintendo. So that's kind of a bummer. Going the wrong direction, Bubs. Every quarter that they have another bad quarter, people pound their chest harder for Mario, for iOS, and different stuff like that, you know, spread out and get into the software business, become a game development studio as opposed to a hardware company that does games.
And my favorite author / should be best friend, M.G. Siegler, said, he goes, the surprising part isn't the losses. It's the fact that Nintendo pretends that it's not happening.
Yeah.
They're totally fine.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know where this goes. I mean, I thought we all knew where it was going with the at the end of the GameCube's life cycle. I think we're all hoping that they pull the rabbit out of their hat again, but no.
But as we just discussed, not an easy feat.
It's not.
Nope.
You know, and the reality of it is, towards the end of its life, the Wii wasn't doing great. I mean, there was so much momentum behind the Wii that was really what carried it through, like game sales and stuff. But where the PlayStation 3 was still gaining ground, making new sales, coming into the life, it was doing it at the expense of the Wii. The Wii had topped out. And, you know, and the Wii U is selling worse than the Wii was at the end of its life cycle, but, you know, not that much worse. It's, you know, so it's an interesting dilemma that they have. They're, you know, I think this is a longer term trend. My point in bringing that up is I think this is a longer term trend for Nintendo in general, and which is that much more disturbing and that much more shocking when you realize that they're not doing anything about it. So.
Yeah. Yep.
Cool. So.
Okay. My last one is about a new app called Hello World, which is pretty cool. The core idea is it's trying to answer the simple question of where are you and what are you doing? And you might do it with text, maybe with a picture, and your location. And so you post that, and it'll stick around for 25 hours. 24 hours.
That'd be weird.
So that, I don't know. So that your friends can see where you are and where you've been recently, and then it disappears. Like they said, they liked it because they liked the name because it's the very first program you tend to write when you learn a new language, and it also describes what the product is. It's like you're saying hello to the world in your own personal world of friends. And so when you log in, you can see the feed of your friends' latest updates filtered by location, and you can even have them done, if someone's near you, you get pinged. Now, what's interesting about your location is that it doesn't show your exact location. It's more, it's this interesting blend where it'll show, you know, approximate location. So she's like, so it's this interesting blend between the secret and Foursquare, where it's like, yeah, it's to my friends. You know who I am. You kind of know where I'm at. But not totally, not like Foursquare. And you can ping each other, or you can set it up a push notification ping to know when a specific friend is close by to you. And so it's this idea of it's getting back to what Twitter was originally with a location component to it to let people know what you're doing. And But I thought it was a cool idea.
That's a cool
idea.
So
I wanted to share it with you.
Yeah, that is a cool idea. I have a friend that's working on an app that's a very similar service. And
no surprise.
Yeah, kind of. That's what I'm saying is that it's a necessary thing. I mean, or it's not necessarily necessary, but it's definitely a space people are aware that there's opportunity there, but there's not really a service. I actually got pulled into a cool idea that I'm not going to share here because they'd probably be upset if I did. I'll tell you about it later, though. But
okay.
Yeah. So if you made it this far into the podcast, A, thank you. B, sorry. and then, so the last thing I'll wrap up on this is the House of Lords in England has decided that the whole right to be forgotten rules it's wrong. It's
wow.
It's wrong. They're basically like, yeah, it's unfair, it's impractical, it's stupid. Like, and so it's going away. Basically, everything that we said made it
really?
Ridiculous. Yeah. Everything that we said made it ridiculous is they're agreeing. Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's stupid. You can't put the onus of it on Google. And it's impractical and actually doesn't get done what it's supposed to get done. Which is kind of surprising. Usually governments are bad at like retracting that sort of a thing, but it looks like they're gonna scale this back pretty quick. I'm sure it's because Google's spending a lot of money to make sure that it goes that direction. But I thought it was interesting that they agree with us. And I think what's going to happen is they're going to reinterpret it to say it is okay for certain companies under certain individuals under certain circumstances to request that they be removed from a website. So like news organizations can still do news, but like, you know, something like if you've got a review of yourself on a website, you can request the website brings down the review, stuff like that. It was confusing, but they're like, it's not Google's job to go through and police information, especially because it's just dumb. You can go to another, you know, search engine and look it up. Like, it's just impractical. It doesn't do what it's supposed to do. It puts too big of a burden on the wrong person, on the wrong group. So that's always good to see.
That is good to see. That's good news.
It is good news.
The 10th man spoke up.
Exactly.
Oh, man. Cool, man. Hey, a lot of stuff for a down week.
Yeah, right?
But that's all right.
I knew it wasn't a down week.
Yeah, it's never a down week on this podcast. All right, well, oh, I gotta switch my audio. Sorry, Matthew.
That's okay.
You'll survive. Let me switch this real quick. Well, everybody, thank you for joining us. We really do appreciate it. My name is James Furlow, and my space traveling, galaxy guarding brother is Matthew Furlow. And so we will talk next time.